This is the Book of Mormon, Digging Deeper. I'm your host, Mark Swint. I was reading about Henry D. Eyring the other day. He was the father of our current apostle and member of the First Presidency, Henry B. Eyring. He was a scientist and a very prominent chemist. His discovery and explanation of the absolute reaction rate theory changed chemistry in the last century and led to the awarding of the Nobel Prize to a group of chemists working from his theory. It was generally believed that he should have been the recipient, but was denied because of his religion, even though he was the originator of the work. Even the Nobel Prize Committee later acknowledged that he should have been the one to receive the prize, but that determination was made too late to do so. It seems apparent that his faith got in the way. Apparently, faith and science can't share common ground, according to the folks in Stockholm who head the Nobel Committee. Not surprisingly, though, science and religion have been at odds for centuries and will probably continue to be so for some time to come. This shouldn't come as a surprise. The account of the creation in Genesis seems to be significantly out of sync with current and demonstrably reliable scientific theory on a number of points. As a result, theology, which for some reason is always thought of as just one particular school of thought, has been relegated to the dustbin of superstition and myth by the intellectual world. This shouldn't be for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that there are very many different theological schools of thought on very many different points of doctrine. Nevertheless, those first few pages of Genesis seem to lock all theology into the domain of the great unwashed and ignorant people for whom scientific research is just too complicated to comprehend. It is a shame, really, because the real error in this conflict is the conflating of both science and religion as being opposing sides of the same argument, leading to an either-or situation. And this is simply not the case. At least I propose that this is not the case, and I am supported by a great many scientifically minded and trained people who somehow successfully walk on both sides of this line. Today we're going to take a deep dive into the subject of science and religion and explore how and when this divide began, and more importantly, why it arose in the first place. I think you will find the story more compelling than you might think, so I hope you will stick around. The subject of science and religion, some may say the conflict between science and religion, is important to me because I like to think of myself as one of those scientifically minded people. My particular love is physics. I believe that physics governs and controls our entire world. The clouds that form to give us rain, the winds that blow, the birds that fly through the air, the tides that wash our shores, the sun that gives us life, and the gravity that keeps us firmly planted on the ground, and everything else in our world, moves and bends and grows because of physics. And the beauty of that is that physics is absolutely constant and reliable. It never lets us down. It is 100% reliable, and I'm grateful for that. On the other hand, I know that I am a child of a loving and all-powerful Heavenly Father, and I hope by now those of you who have followed this podcast over the last season know how deeply I love the Book of Mormon and the gospel that it supports. Let me say right up front that I find no conflict with my position, and in fact, I believe that the one supports the other. That is, science and religion support each other. There are caveats, however, and I should say that I believe true science and true theology fit perfectly together. There is, however, a great amount of, may I say, historically bad theology, as well as historically bad science. Of course, those two things will always conflict, but the bottom line is, the earth exists. Here it is. We dwell upon it. It was created somehow and by some means. The processes by which the earth was created will be explained eventually in full by rigorous research, which has been going on for thousands of years in one form or another, and I am confident that when that final, ultimate answer is found, we will see that there was a guiding hand in all of it. It was initiated by someone. Someone pushed the button. A few decades ago, astrophysicists studying the Big Bang came to the unavoidable conclusion that something or someone initiated the Big Bang. They had been continuing the research that had been going on for years now, trying to get back to the very smallest fraction of a second after the Big Bang in order to figure out how it all started. What were the conditions that caused the Big Bang? And try as they might, they could not avoid the mathematical indications that demanded a causal initiation, an intentional pushing of the button. That started the whole thing. But they were loath to call it God, so they came up with a term they thought might avoid that embarrassing conclusion. They called it intelligent design, hoping that no one would notice. Well, the religious fundamentalists latched onto that almost immediately and pointed fingers saying, aha, God, we told you so. The scientific community was horrified and immediately distanced themselves from that term as quickly as possible. Additionally, the media spun it to make it appear as though it was the religious folk who came up with the term intelligent design to mask the fact that they were talking about God. The whole thing was a fiasco, but successful. And today, if you ask about the term intelligent design, you will be dismissed with the wave of the hand and a derisive tisk of the tongue. And yet, the astrophysicist had still concluded that someone or something pushed the button. It wasn't always so, this conflict between religion and science. Long ago, very long ago, it was the spiritual leaders who led what we would call scientific research. In those days, it was called natural philosophy, and they were natural philosophers. The term science wasn't developed yet. And then we had men like Archimedes, he of the Eureka I Found It fame. He discovered the theory of displacement and changed boat building and shipping forever. Democritus was another. He postulated the existence of the atom, the atomos, or the smallest indivisible particle of matter. Alexander of Aphrodisias in 326 BC wondered why the light just outside a rainbow was always darker than the light inside. He also noticed that if there were two rainbows visible, this dark band of light was always contained between them. This became known as Alexander's dark band. Look for it the next time you see a rainbow. From the earliest days, people looked at and observed the world around them and wondered why things were the way they were. Their theories didn't always hold up, but they were usually honest attempts to learn. The phases of the moon were a big one. It was so obvious and yet so mysterious. Early thinkers knew it had to be important, but they just couldn't figure out why. It was noticed that crazy and often undesirable things happened during periods of a full or nearly so moon, and so the term lunacy arose to describe the behavior of someone under the influence of the moon. Lunatics is another word that comes from that very same phenomena. It was noticed that the tides seemed to react to both the new and the full moon, so there was that as well. And then there were those few stars that seemed to move across the star field in random ways. These five stars would, at various times, move one way and then stop and then move the other way, or disappear altogether for a time. That backward movement is called retrograde motion, and it was a great mystery. They were called wandering stars, or planetas in Greek, which is why they're called planets today. Then there was the band of condensed stars that form a swath across the night sky. They were called the Via Galactica, which translated means the Milky Way. The word lactic is the root of that, and lactic acid or lactose comes from milk. By the way, our week, comprised of 7 days, is commonly thought to come from the biblical account of the 7 days of creation. Actually, that's not so. The seven-day week existed long before Moses penned Genesis. The Sumerians and the Babylonians both had already devised the seven-day week. They established that week by observing the five wandering planetas of the Greeks, as well as the sun and the moon, which together make seven moving objects in the sky. Different names in different languages have arisen, obscuring that fact a little bit, but check this out. In Latin, we see the heavenly bodies in the names of our days. Monday, which for us represents moon day, is lunes in Spanish and lundi in French. Luna is the Spanish word for moon, and lune is the French word. Mardi or martes for Mars, which is Tuesday in those languages. Miércoles or mercredi for Mercury, which is Wednesday. Jueves or jeudi for Thursday, which represented Jupiter. The words came from the old root word Jove for Jupiter. Jupiter is still sometimes referred to as the Jovian planet. Viernes or vendredi is for Venus and represents Friday. In English, we say Saturday for Saturn Day. The Latin languages substituted variations of Sabbath for Saturday. And then, of course, we have Sunday as the seventh day. These seven celestial bodies were the foundation for the common week. And I find it interesting that even the Encyclopedia Britannica fell into the trap of thinking the week came from Moses' account, even though their own narrative contradicts what they say in the first sentence. Listen to this. Week, a period of 7 days, a unit of time artificially devised with no astronomical basis. Did you catch that? No astronomical basis. But then in the very next sentence they say, evidence indicates that the Jews may have borrowed the idea of the week from Mesopotamia, for the Sumerians and the Babylonians divided the year into weeks of 7 days each, one of which they designated as a day of recreation. Then they go on to say, the Babylonians named each of the days after one of the five planetary bodies known to them, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, and after the sun and the moon. So there you have it, a perfect blend of scientific observation and religious theory. If you think about it, the creation could have been divided into many more parts than seven. In fact, the Jewish Haggadah, or Book of Jewish Traditions, lists 22 different creative periods. I suspect that the division of the creative periods observed by Moses was done in seven segments so as to correlate with the already established week and allow for the establishment of a Sabbath, a day of rest each week, for the observance and worshiping of the God who created all of this in the first place. There was also the inclination and declination of the sun throughout the year. This motion was divided into solstices at the extremes and equinoxes in the middle, which marked important periods of the year. Seasons, they called them, and the passing of one season into another usually triggered celebrations of various sorts, often religious in nature. This fascination with the sky did not rule out other closer-to-home phenomena, such as, how do birds fly? What are clouds? What are volcanoes and tempests? What makes snow turn into water? And why is the sun hot, but not always? Throughout our early history, this curiosity about the world around us was led by the basic premise that a god of some type must be controlling all of this, that a supernatural hand was causing all of this to happen. As people began to realize that there were explainable and understandable processes at work, some took this to mean that there was not a god at the helm. It was all just natural circumstance. This attitude was allowed to arise because the spiritual leaders had made their gods out to be mysterious and ineffable. Their ways were beyond comprehension. No human could understand the ways of an all-powerful God. And yet, mankind was beginning to figure out and understand the processes that governed many of our observable world realities. Therefore, if we could figure them out, they must not be governed by a god. This was the fault of humans, not God. I submit to you that God is the ultimate scientist, that he understands all of the physics of the universe and is therefore able to control it, to employ it, to create and bring about his purposes. After the Greeks, the Romans got involved. Constantine decided to adopt Christianity as the official religion of the Roman Empire. This was not brought about by a deep spiritual conversion, but rather the realization that try as they might, they just could not put down the Christian movement. So, better to adopt it than fight it. But the Christian movement was highly fragmented by the 4th century. This fragmentation had already become evident in the time of Paul, who wrote to the Corinthians, quote, "For it hath been declared unto me of you, my brethren, by them which are of the house of Chloe, that there are contentions among you. Now this I say, that every one of you saith, I am of Paul, and I am of Apollos, and I of Cephas, and I of Christ." Is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you? Were you baptized in the name of Paul? By the time Constantine decided to adopt Christianity a few centuries later, this division had become quite severe, so the first thing he had to do was get a single universal or Catholic doctrine established. This he did by convening a council in Nicaea in 325 AD. The mandate of all collective bishops and priests from around the Roman Empire, which encompassed the entire Mediterranean civilizations, was to come up with one universal doctrine that would cover everything, and I mean everything. It addressed such scientific topics as the structure of the universe, whether there was such a thing as a vacuum of space. Did our atmosphere continue all the way to heaven? What was the sun and the moon and the stars, and so on? It was a noble effort, and many good men debated long and hard to come up with a consensus. It was not without drama, but eventually they came away with their universal or Catholic doctrine. There was a battle for leadership of this new unified doctrine, and two churches were formed. What became the Eastern or Greek Orthodox Church, which followed the Bishop of Constantinople, the Bishop of Constantinople, and the Roman Church, which followed the Bishop of Rome. Eventually, this became the Roman Catholic Church, and the bishop became the Pope. The majority backed the Roman leadership, and they claimed lineage back to Peter. But that's for another podcast at another time. The reason I go into this is because this had the most extreme bearing on the development of the rift between men of science and men of God. Here was the problem. The council at Nicaea was a noble effort, and the gathered clergymen worked hard to accomplish the mandate set by Constantine. However, they made one fatal error. At the end, they declared the new doctrines to be infallible. That meant perfect and without flaw. That also meant they couldn't be changed. Anyone who disagreed with the doctrines of this newly established Holy Roman Empire would be declared a heretic and subject to an awful array of punishments, including death by a number of horrific methods. This had an obviously stifling effect on genuine scientific inquiry and progress. It is my position that this is what led to the next 1,000 years becoming known as the Dark Ages, that period of absolutely no progress or growth in the collective knowledge of mankind. Had the Council said that the doctrines were the best efforts of their knowledge at the time, but also allowed that future discoveries could and would modify their positions, scientific discovery could have continued at the very least 400 or 500 years. We could have had the Wright brothers' first light back in 1400 AD, or Faraday and his discoveries with electricity at the same time. Just imagine where we would be today. Instead, we had people like Galileo, who, when he built a telescope and trained it on Jupiter, he saw 4 moons orbiting that giant planet. His observations were incontrovertible, but his conclusions ran afoul of the established doctrines that disallowed anything to orbit anything other than this Earth, the center of the universe. For his conclusions and his thoughts about the solar system, he was found to be heretic and was sentenced to death. However, the timely intervention by the only people powerful enough to defend him, the Medici, saved his life, although he was consigned to house arrest for the remainder of his days. Nevertheless, the fuse had been lit and the march of discovery in the face of the Inquisition was on. By the end of the 15th century, the rebirth was begun. The Renaissance would not stop until scientific and cultural and artistic freedoms were once again allowed. The Dark Ages were over, but the damage was done. The lines had been drawn, and you were either on the side of science or the side of God. There was no in-between. This is where the battle of science and religion had its birth, and it still prevails to a greater or lesser degree today. And that's sad, because there really is a great deal of common ground. In fact, it is all common ground. All that is needed is for true theology to come out and for true science to reveal itself. When that happens, we will see that they are the same thing. Now, most of us realize that if there are thousands of differing religious opinions out there, they can't all be true. But I bet some of you cringed when I said true science. Well, the fact is, there has been an awful lot of incorrect and bad science throughout the centuries. It is my position that science and theology should be partners in discovery and understanding. It is also my point that they occupy two very different jobs in this quest. I believe it was the job of prophets and theologians to tell us what the reality was and is, and then for the scientists to tell us how and why it is as it is. For example, we all know that birds fly and have known that since the beginning. But simply knowing that they fly doesn't tell us how they fly. That question was left to scientists, and it puzzled them for millennia. Finally, in the 19th century, people started to figure it out, and eventually the laws of aerodynamics were discovered. Once we learned that, then we could employ those laws to build airplanes and span the globe as we do today. The laws had always been in place, and birds were born with the equipment to naturally take advantage of those laws, but we couldn't figure them out. Lightning was observed by the very first humans, but misunderstood until the 18th century when Benjamin Franklin and others began to unlock its secrets. That led to the understanding of electromagnetism and the eventual electrification of the world, which has changed our world more than any other single discovery in history. Today, virtually everything you see and touch employs electricity to one degree or another. So you see, even science has not had a monopoly on truth and knowledge forever. They develop just as the rest of philosophy and religious knowledge does. Surprisingly, in many cases, it was religion and theology that preceded scientific discovery. Truths revealed by prophets often led to scientific inquiry and discovery. Again, the what was followed by the how and the why. I'll show you what I mean. Let's start with the very first page of the Bible. Keep in mind that Moses was an observer, not a scientist. His job was to tell us what happened at the creation rather than how it happened. On the first page, he says, "In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the waters. You see, just a statement, an observation, not an explanation. Now, I read this to say that in the beginning, the earth was covered with water. No mountains or valleys of dirt and rock. This idea was followed up a few verses later when he said, "And God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together unto one place, and let the dry land appear." Now, this was written 3,500 years ago, and it said that the earth was covered with water in the beginning. There was no landmass, no mountains, and then, it says, the waters gathered together and the dry land appeared, as if to say that the land was always there, just under the water. Moses did not claim that God created the dry ground with a poof and a wave of a magic wand. He didn't say, boom, let there be land. No, it was always there, hiding under the water. Now, before I get to the science, let me make this observation. Moses grew up in the desert. He was a desert dweller. He probably saw the Mediterranean. We don't know for sure, but he did see the Nile. In fact, he was plucked from it as a baby when he was in a reed basket. But for the most part, his life was spent in an arid, almost lifeless desert, lots of sand and dry ground. If Moses had been making up the creation story as a fable or a myth, don't you think it would have been more likely that he would have drawn upon his experience in the desert and started out with something like, "In the beginning, the earth was a lifeless and barren desert"? I'm sure that for Moses, the whole world was a desert. That's all he ever saw. The only real green and abundant life he would have encountered was near an oasis. And to a nomadic desert dweller, oases were crucial for life. They brought the water, and water gave life. So it would have been reasonable for him, were he making up this story, to have said, "And there sprang forth an oasis, and the oasis gave water to the ground, and there sprang forth from the dry ground grass and trees and life in abundance. And the water flowed from the oasis to fill the whole earth, and life was born." See, I think something like that would have sprung from the mind of a nomad, a desert dweller, if he were tasked with explaining how the earth was formed. Unless, of course, he wasn't making it up. If he was given a vision from heaven, then no matter how fantastic it might have seemed to him, based on his life experience, he would have recorded what he was shown, without consideration for what he had personally experienced throughout his own life. And then the part about the waters being gathered together and the dry land appearing. Now that's interesting. He might have just said, "And God created the ground whereupon man might stand." But no, he was specific about the waters moving, being gathered together, so that the dry land could appear. Well, this description stood, and still stands, for the last 3,500 years. And all the while, natural philosophers and scientists have wrestled with the question of how the earth came to be. There were many theories, but finally, during my lifetime, the theory of plate tectonics came forward. Listen to this from the National Geographic Encyclopedia. It says, "Plate tectonics is a scientific theory that explains how major landforms are created as a result of Earth's subterranean movements. The theory, which solidified in the 1960s, transformed the Earth by explaining many phenomena, including mountain-building events, volcanoes, and earthquakes." Now, did you catch that? It says, "This theory, which solidified in the 1960s. That's when I was in high school. It wasn't until the 1960s, and that's 3,500 years after Moses, if you're keeping track. But what is plate tectonics? Well, it is now the accepted geological theory that describes land formation on this earth. If you were to take Geology 101 in college, this is the first thing you would learn about. And when you took your first test, one of the first questions you would be asked is, describe the earth before the tectonic plates began to move. And the correct answer is, the earth would have been featureless and covered to a uniform depth by water. You would be correct. The next question you would be asked is to describe what happened when the plates began to move. And here, you would get to explain how one plate moves under another in a process called subduction, which moves the overlying plate upward. This shift causes low spots where the plates meet, allowing water to gather there, and the lifting causes mountains and other land masses to come up out of the water. Again, you would be correct. Now, imagine what this would look like if you were to see a speeded up video of this, you know, like on the Discovery Channel, or like you would probably see in a vision of the world. Moses' description of what he saw agrees exactly with what geologists now say is exactly what happened. Exactly. The only difference is Moses did not say how this happened. He simply reported what he saw. Oh, and by the way, he said it 3,500 years before the scientists did. The point here is that we have an agreement between good science and good theology. And I should point out that before the last century, science in general and geology in particular strongly disagreed with Moses' account. Now, let's get to this notion that God is somehow immune from the laws of physics. As a kid, I was taught that God was God because he was all-powerful. He was not bound by any laws. He was omnipotent. He could do anything he wanted. Well, maybe he could, but not because he wasn't under the same physical laws we are under, but rather because he knew and understood and understands all of the laws of our universe. And when I say all, I include those laws we have yet to discover, and there are many yet to be discovered. There is so much about the universe that we still don't know. But interestingly, in our world, every time we make a major discovery, it opens the door to enormous new capabilities. Look how transportation changed when we finally figured out how birds fly. We said, aha, that's how they do it. And we began to use that new understanding to make ourselves fly. The very same laws existed in the days of the cavemen, but they didn't know them, so they couldn't use them. We already mentioned electricity, which has always existed. And now virtually everything we touch uses electricity in some way or another. The discovery of DNA changed the world of medicine, and, by the way, might give us a glimpse into how the resurrection might be brought about. Now, I could go on and on with all the discoveries we've made, but the truth is, as we learn about our physical world, we become more and more powerful and more capable of doing things that to our ancestors would make us appear as gods. The point is, knowledge is power. Knowledge brings power. Knowledge unlocks secrets that have remained hidden since the beginning of time, and each new discovery only adds to our ability to do things. Why would we think that God would need to be free from the laws of the universe in order to be God? Where would that idea come from? Doesn't it make more sense that his power would come from the knowledge of all things, things which we are still striving to learn and understand? In Alma 42, there is a discussion about the demands of justice and mercy, and in that text is an interesting phrase. It says, "Now the work of justice could not be destroyed. If so, God would cease to be God." And then again a few verses later it says, "Justice claimeth the creature and executeth the law, and the law inflicteth the punishment. If not so, the works of justice would be destroyed and God would cease to be God." One might think that this is talking about some philosophical concept of justice and mercy and law, but I think it is revealing much more than that. First of all, it shows that the law has some power over God, and that he is bound by it as we are. It says clearly that if he denied the law its justice, he would cease to be God. Now, just that very notion, that God could cease to be God, would be considered heretical in any other venue in the world. God is all-powerful and above all law, according to every other religion in the world. And yet, we have these scriptures saying God would cease to be God. Perhaps it is the law that gives God his power, his omnipotence, his ability to create the world. If so, then we can make a compelling case for God being God precisely because he is the most knowledgeable of all the laws and conditions of the universe, not because he is immune to them. After all, if he were immune to any and all laws, then what would cause him to cease to be a god? One would think that the laws are put in place to restrict us, to control us. And that may be true for political laws, but the laws of science are quite to the contrary. They exist to empower us, to give us abilities that we otherwise wouldn't have. Our only challenge is to learn them so that we can employ them and rely on them. They will never change and will always work. If I am building a house and I want lights in it and electricity at the outlets, I must learn how to wire it properly. The laws of electromagnetism are very rigid and demanding. If I don't wire the house perfectly, it won't work. No matter how sincere I was when I wired it, no matter how desperately I need it to work. Do it right, though, and it will work every time. We all know the law of gravity. It never goes away. It never takes a break, thankfully. And yet, when I fly an airplane, it would appear that I am breaking the laws of gravity. I'm defying gravity. Not so. In fact, without gravity, I wouldn't be able to fly. I'm not breaking that law, but rather employing higher laws that, in fact, use gravity and rely on it to allow me to create lift to fly. But I have to use those laws correctly, or they will quickly bring me down and kill me. I guess you could say that I work in partnership with the laws to bring about whatever task I undertake. So it is with God. There is no magic in the creation that Moses witnessed. In fact, if you think about it, why did there even need to be 7 creative periods, or 22, or whatever number you'd like to pick? If God had not been bound by any laws at all, he could have simply snapped his fingers and the world would have popped into existence in an instant, ready to go, full of life. But no, the creation was a process. First there was one thing, then another part was added on the second day or period, and then another, and then another. It was a process, a planned out and precisely executed plan that ultimately resulted in the earth we live on. It certainly took more than 7 24-hour days to accomplish, but it followed a pattern, and it worked, because here we are. It followed the science that allowed it to happen. Henry D. Eyring once said, "I believe that God directed the creation of the heavens and the earth, and that he left clues to his work in everything he did. And the sciences, geology, chemistry, physics, and astronomy, are the disciplines devoted to uncovering those clues." I too believe that. I believe that God is the ultimate scientist and that he respects the universal laws that govern not only our world, but all the creations that have or ever will exist. I believe that correct science will validate correct theology and that we will one day see how all of this was done by a loving God. We are promised that we will one day learn how it was all done. This from the 101st section of the Doctrine and Covenants. "Yea, verily I say unto you, in that day, when the Lord shall come, he shall reveal all things which have passed, and hidden things which no man knew, things of the earth, by which it was made, and the purpose thereof, things most precious, things that are above and things that are beneath, things that are in the earth and upon the earth and in heaven." I so look forward to that day, and I will relish the truth that will flow like the waters of life. I know that in that day we will see perfect fusion of knowledge between theology and science. The what that we experience will be accompanied by the how and the why it was done. At last we will know that it is all part of one eternal realm. I bear you my testimony that this gospel is true, that God does exist, and that we are part of his handiwork. I know that the pursuit of knowledge and truth will only bring us closer to him, so that in the end we may become heirs of his kingdoms and glory, and may go on to fulfill our own destinies that he has planned for us to do since the beginning. And I leave you this testimony in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen. I'm Mark Swint. Thank you for listening.